Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we are joined for the second time by Golf Channel analyst and former PGA Tour winner Aaron Oberholzer. The pre-podcast conversation was a fascinating one, so I decided to roll without the usual intro, so we'll jump right into it. Thanks for listening, and as always, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast in iTunes or Stitcher. Without further ado, here's Aaron Oberholzer.
I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Wanted more of a restoration. They wanted to bring it back. They wanted to bring back the Mackenzie bunkering because Alistair had done the original bunkering at Cal. McCann did the routing in the greens, and then Mackenzie did the bunkering. So the bunkering is all, especially on the back nine, is all like right where it was supposed to be in the 20s and the teens when he built it. The back nine's a full restoration. The front nine, because of eminent domain, he had to create new holes. So he tried to get it back to kind of sort of what it was like, but the front nine's kind of a new nine.
Yeah, they have that, what is it, 6, 7, 8 are all new holes.
Yes, 7's a new hole, 8's a new hole. Let's see, 2, 3, 4, 7, and 8 are all new holes.
Mm-hmm. 3's pretty cool.
2, 3, 4, 7, 8.
Yeah. They're all good holes.
They're all great holes. He did a great job.
The great thing is the fescue and how it plays firm and fast.
Isn't that unreal? I mean, we got guys now who really know golf coming out of there and like quietly whispering to all of our membership when they see us, it plays better than San Francisco Club, but you didn't hear it from me. It's pretty funny to hear that. I love hearing that because it just, whenever it gets back to an SF Club member, they just go, oh, they get all pissed off.
I love the way Cal Club plays, like from a pure architecture standpoint.
Yeah.
I give San Francisco a little bit of a nod.
Well, but the only reason San Francisco, I think, gets the nod is because of the blue blood history. Mm-hmm. That's it. And it's, you know, but honestly, I can't remember the guy's name, but the president at the time, I went out and I've played San Francisco, you know, 20 times, maybe a little more, maybe a couple more times than that. And it's great. I mean, it's awesome. But when he made the decision and it was split on the board and it just barely passed to take it back to Tillinghast's original design from, in my opinion, it actually took away from the golf course. I like the golf course the other way. They like changed holes like, I don't know, 12, or like 13, 14, 15 or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And took it back to the original Tillinghast design. And I didn't like it at all. I liked the course the old way the way I played it in college and just after college.
It's Zach's caddy, but Andy Martinez said that too.
Yeah,
legendary caddy. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like what they did. And the guy came up to me and asked me right after I finished my round there, I think it was either the last time or the time before last that I played. And I said, quite honestly, I said, you want my honest answer? And he goes, absolutely. I go, I don't like it. I told him right to his face, probably why I haven't been inviting back there, you know, in a long time. But I just, yeah, I didn't like it at all. Didn't like it at all. I like the old golf course better.
I hadn't played the old course. I really like 14. I like 14, 15, 16. I love those. A lot of people said stuff about those holes, like, and how they didn't like them to me and Zach. And both of us kind of were like, those were like some of our favorite holes on the course, which is kind of crazy. I mean, you guys
didn't play the design previous.
Exactly. Like so 13.
I think you might change your mind if you would have played the old design.
Yeah. I think 12 might be one of the best holes ever.
12, let's see, 10, 11, the par 3. Oh, phenomenal par 4. Absolutely. And I think what's lost on that golf course is just how good the bunkering is and where Tillinghast put the bunkers and the shaping of the bunkers and the visuals of the bunkers. Funny thing is I like the back nine there. I do. But because of the way they changed it, I'm not as big a fan of the back nine anymore. The front nine is like a lesson in golf work architecture, yeah. In my opinion. The front nine at SF Club one of the greatest nine holes of golf I've ever played. There's no doubt. For shot values, for every shot value around that front nine, it is awesome. One of my favorite nine holes in all of golf. The two par threes, just incredible. It's just a special nine holes. The back nine, well, like I said, for me, my money, I'll take the older nine. It's just okay. 10 and 11 are great. 12 is great. But then you start at 13 and go 13, 14, 15. And then I think 16, it gets back to normal again. I think, if I remember correctly, that's still an original hole.
Yeah.
And then 17 is one of the best par fours in California.
Yeah, that's a great par.
18's a good, and 18's a good solid, you know, fun eagle opportunity finishing hole on the back.
I'll tell you what, walking down like the 18th on an afternoon out there, because like there's nobody out there, is like kind of like one of the coolest, but also like eerie feeling you'll ever have in golf. Like, I mean, the sun's going down and there's just nobody out there, and you're just like, you just had like a great golf experience too.
Yeah, it is. And that's I think where SF gets the nod for that because there's so few members and so few of those members play on a regular basis, they're able to have that kind of experience for everybody out there. Everybody gets to kind of have that experience out at SF, whereas you don't get that same experience at Olympic Club. You don't get it at Merced. And to a certain extent, you don't get it at Cal. Cal's probably, in my opinion, the closest. SF's really the only course that produces that feeling you're talking about. I know exactly the feeling you're talking about. I feel like I'm walking on eggshells. I don't like that feeling. So yeah. I just, that feeling of kind of that uppity staunchness, that's a minus to the club, in my opinion. And SF kind of gives that air. Cypress gives that air. So they're not, that's why those two aren't in my top five of all time. That's why I don't put those guys. So it's a feeling for me that I get on these deals that I just don't, that air I don't like.
The Cal Club vibe and just like everything about like how the golf course is presented, how, you know, the club works, everything there is like top notch. Like,
well, when Al, did you meet Al Jamieson?
Yeah, I've met him a couple times now.
So Al's like a father to me, another dad to me. And I've known Al since I was 14. And when he came to me with the vision of Cal and what he wanted to do to it, I was probably in my, let's see, I had, come to think of it, I think I just won AT&T. So he came to me and he says, here, this is what we want to do. This is what we want to do. And he was the president at the time of the changes and the change of the way the changes got voted in. He's really the catalyst for why the club is the way it is right now. That's his legacy. He turned this club around, single-handedly practically, turned the club around. And I said to him, I said, Al, your goal, in my humble opinion, your goal should be to make this the Whisper Rock or Plantation of, in the desert, Plantation, of Northern California, the Players Club, the club the guys want to come to play. Now, obviously, we allow women not to be members, but they can play at those other two places. They don't even want them to play half the time. But that, I said, that should be the goal of the California Golf Club, is to be the Players Club, not a staunch uppity club that you have to be a blue blood to get into like SF, but not Olympic Club where, you know, the masses play and they have 1,500 members, and not a country club. It's a golf club for people who love golf, know golf, love to compete, and are good players. And that should be the goal, only with old school design principles versus new school stuff. And that, I think he did. I think the guys did a good job accomplishing that, Andy.
I would wholeheartedly agree. I've started to think this new theory about tour golf, and you know, I'm a big believer that par doesn't really matter. And something I would rather have people judge a golf course on is how many different types of shots does it require the world's best players to hit? Because that's you know, why they're the greatest players in the world. So like Cal Club was one that jumped to mind. Like, what do you think a winning score would be at Cal Club if they hosted a PGA Tour event? But would it be a more well-rounded test of golf?
Well, that's a great question. I think the guys would tear Cal apart, quite honestly. I really do. If you because it would play so short, because Cal is now fine fescue and bent everywhere, and we've sand capped the whole golf course, and we're as we like to say around the club every once in a while, we're down with brown. Meaning it's cool if the golf course browns out a little bit. We're not going to freak out. We don't need to, quote unquote, as I call it, Augustify it. And not everything has to be sparkling green, emerald green everywhere. We don't believe in that at California Golf Club. We want to see the ball run. We want to see it run hard. We turn the sprinklers off. We hand water a lot, which is, in my opinion, what did they do in the 20s? Well, what they did in the 20s, they didn't have triplex mowers and they didn't have Norelcos, basically, that shaved the greens down to nothing. That's for sure. So the grass grew a little longer. It played slower. There's no doubt. But in the wintertime, but they didn't have the fancy watering systems they have now, too. So in the wintertime, when it rained in the Bay Area, which was obviously fairly frequent, it'd play soft and slow. But in the summertime, when the rain stopped in late May and wouldn't come back until early to mid-October, that place was a racetrack. An absolute racetrack, as racetracks go back in the 20s and 30s. And that's how we want it to play now. We want that sucker to play like a racetrack from June 1st to as long as we can get it to stay dry. And then hand water as needed, throw on a sprinkler here or there just to, you know, just to give it a little moisture so the grass doesn't completely freak out. But stressing fescue, from what I've talked to Thomas Bastis, who was our old superintendent, who's schooled me on a lot of this stuff, stressing fescue is good. And it also helps keep the poana out, because poana likes moisture and we don't want the poana in there. So the drier we keep it, the more, I believe it is, I can't remember. Is it alkaline or acidic that poana doesn't like?
I think
it's... Yeah, I can't remember. One of those two we want more of, and I can't remember which one it is. Thomas told me, and I just forgot. But we want to keep the grass, one of those two, more, so it helps keep the poana out. So whatever keeps the poana out, because that's kind of – when the guys told me about how they were going to rebuild Cal when we rebuilt it, that's how he did it. And now to get to your original question, because it plays so firm and fast, guys are going to be hitting flip wedges in everywhere, Andy. So we'd have to turn one into a par four. And we'd probably have to turn 17 into a par four.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 and 17 would have to be par fours. We'd have to play it as a par 70. And even then, I believe the winning score would be somewhere around, let's see, that's 280 as a par for four rounds. So I'd have to say the winning score would probably be in the mid to low 260s,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
So
yeah, it'd be somewhere between 14 and 20 under, I think, would win at Cal. And that's if you got the greens to 12 and you put proper pins out there.
So
proper tour pins.
My whole theory goes around removing removing the idea of score. But would Cal Club require a player to hit more types of shots and be a better test than, say, like last week's course, PGA National, where everything's through the air? And, you know, kind of tells you.
No doubt. Because you can use the ground at Cal. The one thing that Kyle Phillips built in when he redid Cal, the one thing he built in was he built in options. So it's shaved everywhere. There's very little rough. And what rough we have is what Augusta or what you would call a first cut now, like 2 inches tops, maybe an inch and a half in spots. And so you know, when you miss a green and it rolls down, you sit there and you go, okay, what do I want to do? Like, especially the front aprons of greens. Okay, do I want to bump this in? Because you have that option in with fine fescue. Do I want to fly it on? Do I want to take that opportunity off this tight fescue and fly it on? Do I want, you know, you have options. I can putt it. I can take a hybrid. I can take a 7-iron. I can take a 4-iron. The one thing that Kyle wanted, he wanted options, because that's what Mackenzie gave you if you really looked at the way he designed golf courses back in the day. He gave you angles, and then he gave you options. Mm-hmm. And if you missed an angle or you missed a proper play off the tee, now your options are limited. Yeah. So it really, actually, funny enough, starts with the tee ball, even though you would think, well, that's the more the thinking of a U.S. Open style golf course. Not so much, in my opinion. You have to create angles on a Mackenzie golf course in order to give yourself more options. And if you don't, your options become drastically limited as you move along with poorer and poorer angles.
Yeah, it kind of goes to the thinking of, like, what are everybody's favorite golf courses to watch championships played on? Augusta,
yeah.
The old course. These are places with the old course doesn't care what you shoot, but what it is about is having all the shots in your arsenal to win. And that's what so many PGA Tour courses don't do anymore. And everybody's become so fascinated with par and difficulty that I think that's been lost, is like, how many golf shots does this require? Yeah.
I've called it forever, even on TV. I think when we get into discussions about this, which is rare, but I've had a few discussions on this in the past with guys, it's shot values. Mm-hmm. What kind of shot values does the course present itself? I think Cal presents itself with a lot of great shot values, not only off the tee, but as far as second shots. I think the par threes are very underrated at Cal. I think that Our old seventh hole, now sixth hole, might be the toughest. It's a par three, but we call it the toughest par four in the Bay Area.
You've got to hit it on like a blanket there, or else dude, it's a bogey.
Andy, you're trying to literally hit it on the hood of a freaking Volkswagen when with it blowing downwind off the left, which is the prevailing wind at, you know, 10 to 20 miles an hour some of the time.
The first time I played it, I hit it to like 6 inches, and I was like, oh, this hole's not that hard. And then the next time I played it, I think I like struggled to make bogey.
Oh yeah, that's why we call it the toughest par four in the Bay Area. So for a reason. So that's been there all the time. But Kyle built. We had to build a few new holes on the front nine, just to try to bring back some of the old holes before Eminent Domain built Westboro Boulevard right there and took away some of our original holes. So he did a good job. Number 2, 3, 4 are all new holes. And then 7 and 8 are new holes, and 8 is the next par three. 240 yards, probably plays about 12 downhill, and then again down and off the left, same direction. That's the only thing I don't like about 8 is it runs the same direction as number 6, so you don't get a different wind, but it's a different challenge with a different club and elevation change.
And that green
is nasty.
That green runs back or front to back. Too.
Even though it's pitched from back to front, mm-hmm. it's fast going from front to back, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. It's really a weird. That's the way that land sits at Cal. I think that has a lot to do with how difficult those greens play and putt. And even on the old golf course that was bastardized for years by greens committees who thought they knew what they were doing. You always ask yourself, where's the airport? Where's SFO? Because mm-hmm. everything's going to SFO, especially on that back nine. Everything's going to SFO. It's not that much different now. That land still kind of everything wants to go to SFO, except for a couple of holes that you really have to have some local knowledge on. But I think the guys, they'd still take it low there. But if you're in relation to par, which I know you're not a huge fan of, But as people understand it, in relation to par, I think guys would take it low, but they would have a blast playing it for 4 days.
Yeah.
They would have an absolute blast because they would have so many different shot values to look at. Wedges, long irons, mid irons, short irons. That you got to hit all the shots. You got to hit cuts. You got to hit draws, high, low. You got to play a lot of different shots around that golf course to be successful, especially if they get that 20-mile-an-hour northwest wind.
Yeah, I think you'd also see, like, you'd see that Riviera variety where you have all different types of players. It's not just a pure ball strikers course. Like, you know, you'll see flushers up there at the top, but you'll also see guys that just have like a knack of getting it done inside 125. They're kind of magicians and are able to pull off these, you know, these cool shots from being short-sighted on short grass.
You know who I think would play really well there are the guys like Kevin Na. Kevin Na's of the world, the grinders at Cal, especially when the wind blows. Because the great equalizer on that golf course is the wind. And the funny thing is that, you know, people would say to me that, no, the course would go, Aaron, why wouldn't you change 15 into a par 4 instead of 17? Well, number one, 17, even though it's like 540 yards, it's straight downhill downwind. So, and you can run it onto that green. And that green kind of goes from front to back to a certain extent towards the SFO.
Yeah.
The reason I wouldn't say that about 15, even though 15 is only 495 yards or 490 yards,
that one plays
it's straight uphill and it's dead into a 20 mile an hour breeze. There have been plenty of days I've hit driver and have come up short of that course. And that was when I was healthy.
Yeah.
But, and I still had speed and I could still pop it out there a decent ways. You know, I mean, only on a calm day can I get a driver and a hybrid there.
Yeah,
in these days.
That hole's a beast for 490. It's I mean, especially in the afternoon when that damp air comes in. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's brutal. It's brutal. And, you know, it depending on what time of year you played the tournament there, I mean, it's much like Pebble Beach. You know, that whole area, the microclimates that stretch throughout the Bay Area to Monterey to the Central Coast where I grew up. You could be dying of heat out there, you know, like you can in August and September, or like you said, your fingertips are going numb this time of year, you know, when that, even on a sunny day, when that northwest wind comes in and nature's air conditioner kicks on, your fingertips are literally going numb. You lose your touch, you lose your feel, and it becomes a lot harder golf course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's kind of I was getting ready for this podcast and I just was thinking about golf courses. I started thinking about Cal Club and I think it's more about hitting shots than score.
Yeah, I think that's well said, Andy.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I judge a golf course. That's why I think I look at Pasatiempo the way I do.
Oh.
Pasatiempo is 6,600 yards with 1 foot in the back rough off of every tee.
That course is awesome.
And it's all you want. It's all you want. If they get those greens to, they don't even need to get them to 12. They get them to 11. It's all you want.
There aren't many pin positions on a few of those greens with greens or with green speeds at 11.
Oh, that's true. I mean, you lose so many pins on those greens, even getting them to 11. I agree. You're limited for sure.
Did you watch the golf yesterday? Is JT the best player in the world right now?
That's a great question. I think that I've seen the arguments on Twitter about how he should be the best player in the world. You know, wins is how everybody's judged. And over the last, 16 months, he's got, wins or 8 wins?
Seven wins.
Over the last 16 months. And no one has that many wins over the last 16 months. It's hard to say he's not if that's your measure. There are definite things that are wrong with the official world golf ranking, but when you look at what he's done and you go down his OWGR finishes, okay, he hasn't been as consistent as Rahm, even though Rahm hasn't won as much, he hasn't been as consistent as Rahm. Number over the last year and a half, he hasn't been. Rahm's had more top fives, da 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 da, all that, but. I compared him and Rahm. I didn't compare him and Spieth, but there's a reason why he's still third, and not number one. And I believe that you can go ahead and make arguments against the OWGR all you want. And they would probably, some of them would be valid. But for the most part, it's consistency. And divisor. I mean, you know, if you keep your divisor low, you can kind of game the system to a certain extent. Quite honestly, that's kind of the biggest flaw in the whole system is a guy who plays more is penalized for the most part. And so until they fix that, until they truly fix that, I don't think they've fixed it completely. Then guys are still going to be getting penalized for playing more golf versus playing less golf. So to answer your question fully, right now he's playing the best golf, I believe, over the last – I'm going to go this way. Over the last year, he's playing the best golf of anybody in the world. There's no doubt. If you take the last year, better than DJ, better than Jordan, even though they both have a major. But he's playing the best golf. When he gets it going, there's not a lot of people that can stay with him, actually. DJ can stay with him. Spieth needs his A game to stay with him. Rory, in my opinion, needs his A game to stay with him. But there's not a lot of guys that can no one can beat him without their A game.
Yeah.
No one can beat Justin without their A game. There's no doubt when Justin has his A game. It's proven to be as good as anybody's in the world.
I watched him at Riv for those first two rounds with Tiger, and I just forgot how good he was. And he did it last night was like the thing that it's the wedge play with everything else. He's a great driver of the golf ball. He's a great iron player. He's a great wedge player now, and he's a great putter. Everybody's got their defined like great skill. It's like you bring up John Rahm, Dustin Johnson, or Rory, you're going to talk about their driving ability. But with Justin, it's everything.
Yeah, he's got a very well-rounded game, and he's worked extremely hard to get there. And him and his dad have addressed the right areas at the right time in the right way. And he hasn't done it overnight. It's taken a lot of work. Because when he first came on tour as a young guy, I remember looking at the stats going, oh, my God, this kid can hit it off the planet at any given time, and he doesn't know which direction it's going off the tee. But if he ever learns how to dial it in, he's going to be really hard to beat. And then I remember looking at him going, Jesus, if this kid could make a putt inside of 10 feet, he's going to be tough to beat. And then I looked at him and went – then he figured that out, and I go, Jesus, if this kid could hit a wedge close to the hole, he's going to be a world beater. And then he figured that out. So he's figured everything out step by step, you know, and then finally said, now, if this kid can play with a lead, he's going to be right there with Spieth, DJ, and those guys. And he's learned how to do that as well. So it's a step by step process that he's followed every step that he's need to, and he's addressed every issue that he's had within his game. And he's done it in a manner, pretty much better than everybody else. And I'd put him right up there with DJ as far as the way he systematically kind of changed his game to what he needed to do to be one of the best in the world. Jordan is close there too, but the issue I have with Jordan, and I love Jordan's game, but he's never going to have ridiculous speed and distance like DJ and Rory and Justin or Rahm. He's never going to be there. And quite honestly, in the era we live in, that is going to be a detriment. And I said it 3 years ago at the Masters when he won by four shots and shot 18 under, and everybody was like, he's going to dominate. And I said, no, he's not going to dominate. And I got killed for it on social media when I said that on air. I said, no, he's not going to dominate. And Ryan Burr, who's my host, he's looking at me like I'm crazy. I'm like, no, because putters go cold, number one. We've seen that. Putters go cold. And distance dominates in this day and age. And Justin has that. And he's not going to wake up and automatically lose 20 yards off the tee. So that's a massive advantage that he has along with Rahm. But he's been quicker to refine his game. Rahm's still got a ways to go. He's still younger, obviously, and has more time than Justin, even though they're both young. Rahm still has more time. to get that done. And when Rom does the same things as Justin does, because Rom's not there yet with his wedges, with his short game, with his play, with his refining the little things that JT has. When Rom does it, oh my gosh, then we're in for a treat, because DJ's already there. He could probably refine his putting even more, in my opinion. I think that's always something he can do better. But Rom's a good putter. Rom just needs to refine some of his iron play, some of his wedge play.
Yeah.
His putting's pretty good. There's no doubt. He's an excellent putter now. But when that iron game from 125 to 175 and some little wedge stuff gets fixed on Rom, holy mackerel, he's going to be – him and JT are going to give Justin – or excuse me, Dustin, a run at number one. There's no doubt. There's no doubt.
Yeah, and then we'll be talking about like guys like Sam Burns and Cameron Champ, we're talking about JT. The youth explosion is just insane out there.
Yeah, it's crazy, and there are some theories behind why that is, and you can name probably five different theories on why that is, and you'd be correct on all of them, probably.
I was gonna ask you, this is a question I had written down. Would you contribute the youth movement more to technology, training, or Tiger?
I'd put Tiger last on that list. I would say the youth movement would be more towards technology, and one in particular, TrackMan. TrackMan's been the single biggest technological advance in golf, in my humble opinion, since the golf ball change in 2003, the drivers. Now, the drivers in 2003 weren't up to the ball. The ball hasn't changed since 2003. When Titleist came out with the Pro V1X, that changed everything. Changed everything, without a doubt. Okay? But the drivers weren't up to snuff. The drivers couldn't unload what that ball could really do. Now, the technology and the drivers are such, probably within the last 2-3 years, to where it can really take advantage of that ball. Then you talk about now, then you throw in there on top of that, you throw in training, proper diet. And these guys train like athletes and live like proper athletes now and do the things for their bodies like proper athletes. And then now you've got young stud athletes who could have played a lot of different sports and been good at them, like baseball or basketball or tennis in some people's cases. And now you've got lots of speed combined with phenomenal equipment, combined with now the coup de grace, in my opinion, which is TrackMan.
Yep.
On top of all this, to be able to self-diagnose and optimize to the nth degree, and then after that, it's a weapon for these guys like no other, in the fact that it gives you confidence knowing you're doing the right thing, because a number equates to something. You can everything's measurable, and you know what good is based on a number. This is how these guys are learning these days. I have a very good friend whose son who's like a younger brother to me, who just signed with the University of Alabama, and he's going to go play for Alabama. Frankie Sappen, who they just got a TrackMan, and the amount of how much better he's gotten with his wedge play in the last 2 months since he got that TrackMan is astounding. When we go play, astounding, because he just works on his wedges constantly. He went from being a not very good wedge player, even by top junior standards, to a phenomenal wedge player by junior standards, collegiate standards, and maybe even low-level professional standards. You know, web.com tour, Canadian tour standards, like within 2 months because of TrackMan.
Yeah, I feel like JT is like the ultimate like TrackMan test case, where you've got this 150-pound guy, but he swings it so efficiently and like optimizes the launch. So he hits it so high and so far. But, I mean, like what you just said about the wedge play, that's what the game has turned into, is if you're a high level player if you drive it well and wedge it well and putt well, you're going to be a great player.
Yeah, I don't even know that you need to drive it that well. In my humble opinion, Andy, I honestly think that the biggest stat for me for guys that drive it over 300 yards is distance from the edge of the fairway. You know, how can you keep it between the white stakes? Can you keep it between the tree lines? If you can do that and you hit it 300 plus on every tee shot, you're going to have a lot of short iron opportunities. So at that point, it becomes about basically your iron play. You're 175 yards in play, 150 yards in play. And how good are you from every different scenario in the rough, out of the fairway, in the first cut? How well can you control your ball? JT does a phenomenal job of that. Tiger does a phenomenal job of that and always has throughout his career. And so the game's changed. And I believe that the single most important factor on the PGA Tour, quite honestly, in my opinion, is iron play.
Yep.
Is second shot performance, is approach shot performance. I think that that's one of the biggest determining factors of giving yourself a chance to win week in and week out. You know, as long as you keep the ball within the uprights, so to speak, it's all about the iron play, quite honestly. You don't have to hit every fairway. Now, obviously, as you get shorter, you know, you start driving it in that 285 to 295 range, in my humble opinion, you got to hit more fairways. And the shorter you get, the more fairways you got to hit, because it gets increasingly more and more difficult the further back you get out of the rough. That's a fact. So the longer hitters have a massive advantage as long as they can, like I said, keep it between the uprights somewhat.
You parlayed perfect into a discussion of with Tiger, who led the field in iron proximity, approach proximity last week. Yeah. And that was obviously like the thing that got lost with Tiger is he's probably the greatest iron player of all time. What are your thoughts on Tiger's play and moving forward?
I think he's right where he needs to be. He just needs more reps, quite honestly. The fact that in his third tournament back in real competition, I'm not really going to use the hero as a litmus test for him. I'd have to say in his third tournament back to lead the field in proximity to the hole on that golf course in those kind of blustery conditions is pretty amazing. Goes to show you how much talent the man has. But it also goes to show you how much he understands what he needs to do with his body when it's healthy to get the club in the position he needs to get it into to hit the shots and create shots. He's a creative genius. And the fact that he's not using anybody for lessons except for himself right now, I love, 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 love. He is the highest level of savant and creative genius that the PGA Tour maybe has ever seen, quite honestly, with his ability to create shots, to visualize, create shots. He has blended the technical and the artistic better than anybody in the history of the game, in my opinion. And I think that if he's allowed to do that continually and he allows himself to do that, he's going to be right where he needs to be, and he's going to give himself opportunities to win tournaments again. The putter looks good. The short game, I walked with him for all 4 days at Torrey Pines. It was flat out amazing, because any other normal human being on the PGA Tour would have missed that cut. Yeah. Tiger finishes like T20 something, which was, again, amazing. And considering where he was hitting that driver. And so I the prospects for him are looking up. Again, just reps. It's the competitive flow, cadence, routine, process, reps. Everything he talks about, the people go blah, 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 and the writers just want to pull their hair out. Unfortunately, to the writers, that's all true. Tiger's speaking the truth.
Yeah.
It's all about cadence, process, routine. Cadence, process, routine. Every professional golfer has a cadence, a process, and a routine. And it's getting back into that competitively that makes you who you are. He just needs to get back to that. And once he does, I think that stuff's going to start falling. I think everything's going to start falling into place, and he's going to give himself opportunities on the back nine to win golf tournaments. He was really close this week.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with the reps thing. Like, I'm nowhere near Tiger, but as a mid-am, like, I play competitively, and every year, like my first tournament out, I shoot like mid to upper 70s. And I'm like, how did I just shoot 77? I hit the ball so good. Like, yeah. But like, sure enough, like the next time out, it's dramatically better. And it's just like, you're like almost like an idiot with scoring, you know, like you hit it well, yes. But like, it's just so you're not in that mode. So like at a high PGA Tour level, you got to imagine that the amount of reps to get back into that form has got to be so high.
Oh yeah. I mean, that without health, he can't put the reps in. So that's the biggest thing for Tiger. But since he basically missed a year, he said it best. And I agree with him 100%, is that he's got to find out what his body is going to allow him to do. Cause he didn't know. He's in uncharted territory, you know, for himself. He doesn't know what that fusion is going to do and what it's going to allow him to do and not allow him to do. But if he can create, pretty good sign that he can create 124 mile an hour club head speed, that he's healthy and that he could do what he needs to do and he can put the work in. You know, he told me about his, we were talking on the fairway in San Diego one hole, and he's got a pretty extensive regimen after every round to get his body recovered. And that's no different than, you know, quite honestly, me now. I understand where he and I are the same age. I understand what my body feels like after a round of golf, and I don't swing at 124 miles an hour and I don't have a fused back. Yeah. So I know exactly what he's talking about there. I mean, my hand hurts from all the surgeries. My low back's a little sore, no doubt. But he's going to be diligent. He's going to do what he needs to do, 'cause this is what he loves to do and he loves to compete. And there's no doubt that, that if he's able to put the reps in, healthy reps in, that he's going to give himself opportunities to win golf tournaments this year. Whether he gets one or not, boy, it'd be hard for me to bet against him, quite honestly, from what I've seen. You know, I think the biggest thing was health. Was he going to be able, for me, was he going to be able to do it healthy? Was the back going to be his new 100%, which might be, you know, his old 70, you know, he might be 75% of what he used to be or 80% of what he used to be. Okay, health-wise. But it's his new 100%. As long as he can swing a golf club without pain, that's all I was concerned about. Now he can put the work in to get back if he has the desire to get it. And I think he has the desire to get it back. And that's, you know, that's the other big thing, is the desire. So now he can start taking proper steps and getting himself into the hunt on Sunday. And then it's basically then it gets to the point does he still have the killer instinct? Because we haven't seen him right there yet. Does he have that old killer instinct? Now, some people are going to say, oh, come on, Aaron. Of course he does. Not so fast. This is a different Tiger. This is a different guy than it was in 2006, 7, 8, you know, and 9. And then he had the personal problems and so on and so forth. And that changes guys in a way. And so, you know, does he have that same killer instinct that he once had, or is he going to have to find a kind of a different way to get that killer instinct to win? I think that's a question that still has to be answered, because he hasn't put himself in that crucial position yet with a serious opportunity to win with a back down on Sunday. We're talking like one back to tied to in the lead with 9 holes to go.
Mm-hmm. My cousin asked me this yesterday, and I was like, whoa, I don't know. Over or under 0.5 wins this year?
For Tiger?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll go over, because I do believe I really do believe he can get one. I really do. I think he can get one. You know, I'm not going to go out and say, oh, it's going to be a major. I'm not there yet. But you got to also look at the fact that, and I got to temper myself a little bit, because I'm excited for what I see for him too. But he also is still playing a very difficult schedule, where he's playing against the best players, like his old schedule, where he was the best playing against the best week in, week out. Torrey, Riv, Honda. And he's not in the WGCs yet, but Bay Hill, don't know what that field's going to look like as of now. Then you got the Masters, and Memorial, you know, I mean, the Players. So, I mean, yeah. He's playing kind of still of his old type schedule that are very difficult golf courses, very demanding golf courses, against the best players, where most of the best players there, where there are a lot of top 50 players playing. You know, we called it back in the day. There was, seems like, and there still is to a certain extent, but when Tiger was playing his best, there was the Tiger Tour, as I called it, and then the regular tour. And the Tiger Tour was all the events that he was at. And he was always playing the best events against the best fields on the hardest venues for the most part. And so, and he's kind of doing the same thing now. So it might be a little tougher for him, but I think he can get one.
So I've got an article that is probably going to come out the day we release this podcast, and it's kind of about the WGCs. We're talking about the best events in the world. Like, I'm kind of just let down by the WGCs, and I'm curious what your thoughts are because of the golf courses they play and the fact that it's not really a world golf championships, because they don't really visit any other parts of the world other than the U.S. and China and Mexico.
Yeah. I think you got to go where the sponsorship dollars say you got to go, man. I mean, to be quite frank, money talks. And in this world, to be quite honest, you know, if you had control over where you could go, you know, and money was, and the guy with the money said, here's all the money for the, if any guy, who cares who it is, goes, you know what? I want it to go to one of the greatest old golf courses, a 20s gem, you know, let's go play at the Montecito Club. Yeah. Let's go play a WGC at the Montecito Club, or let's go play a WGC at RIV in the summertime. Where it would play firm and fast, and it'd be phenomenal, you know, or a WGC, God forbid, at Pebble Beach in the summertime. Oh my gosh, in August or September, you know, it's a scheduling issue, it's a money issue. There are so many things that go into that, Andy.
Yeah, I'm obviously cognizant of the sponsorship thing.
It is a little bit of a downer that they don't play as good at golf courses, and that you know, Austin Country Club is cute and it's fun, and it's a, you know, I think it's a Pete Dye, right?
Yeah, it's a Pete Dye. It's a good match play course.
It's a great match play place. I'd never want to play a stroke play tournament there, but it's a pretty cool match play place. But the biggest issue that I have with WGCs, I used to have a big issue with the fact that it's not at least 132 man field like Phoenix, where there's I mean, if you're going to play against the best, you know what, make it the top 100 in the world, throw in 32 guys from their respective money lists, you know, South African tour, Australasia tour, Asian tour, Japan tour, you know, do that for sure. European tour, do all that for sure. But I always thought, have a cut, man. Make it legit. Have a cut.
Yeah.
And then there's something to think about. But, you know, again, made for TV. They want the stars there all 4 days, so on and so forth. It's, you know, I could sit here and talk about this till I'm blue in the face. But I would like to see it travel more around the world. But guys, again, a lot of guys around the world are home-based here. They don't want to travel.
My thing with the... like the sponsorship thing is, all right, if I'm going to go to a sponsor, and I used to sell sponsorships for a living. Like, if I was going to say, hey, like, this event's going to draw like major championship eyes because we've got the best 100 players in the world playing at Royal Melbourne in Australia during primetime television. Like,
awesome.
The effects of the increased exposure as opposed to like, hey, you know, we're going to do it on Sunday afternoon at, Firestone, which is probably one of the most boring golf courses to watch golf be played at.
Yeah.
Like, the increase in ratings and digital exposure, like in today's world, are so great for playing at a great golf course. Like, Riviera gets great ratings and gets
people
a ton of buzz.
Exactly. People want to see the best players in the world play the most storied, best golf courses in the world. If you, like I said, if you put a WGC at Pebble, oh my gosh, it might blow doors. Because first of all, there's not one guy that's going to say, I don't want to show up.
Yeah.
Everybody's showing up in the top 50 unless they're injured. Okay. And I bet you some guys try to play injured. So Firestone, yeah, I need the gif whenever I hear Firestone and playing Firestone and you talk about it that way. I need the gif of the cartoon character continually hitting himself in the head with a hammer, you know, over and over and over again, because that's what it's like to play Firestone. It's just it's boring and it beats you up on a regular basis, but more so that's just boring. It's just the same thing over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I would like to see it change venues. I'd like to see the WGCs change countries more often and play more great of the great golf courses around the world. And the reason they could do that if they wanted to is if you're going to maintain 75 to 78 player fields, it's not an issue of infrastructure or at least practice facilities, I would think, because even San Francisco Golf Club's range could practically fit a WGC field on it.
Yeah.
You know, so, I would say that, that could be possible, but there, you know, as well as I do, there are so many more moving parts to that. We don't have time to discuss here.
Yeah. I go into a lot of detail, but it's I just think it would be such a cool thing if the WGCs, keep an event in Asia, you have a rotating event in the British Islands, and then you have an event that kind of, or you know, maybe it's the British Isles, South Africa, and Australia rotate every year, and you keep an event in Mexico and South America, and then the US has one event. Like, how cool would that be?
I think it'd be awesome. The only issue is obviously, well, here's the issue that I see. I see the scheduling and then the golf course scheduling, Southern hemisphere, wintertime, summertime sort of thing with Southern and Northern hemisphere kind of thing.
Yep.
You know, I think more than anything,
travel
even
too.
More so than sponsorship money, I think it's a scheduling thing, Andy, quite honestly, is where are you going to put those events?
It kind of screws over the event before and after.
Totally. Especially because if guys have got to go to South Africa, I talked to Trevor Immelman, he does that trip a lot. He knows, he said it's brutal, you know, and obviously I've been the man on the ground in Asia for the Asian events the last 3 years. And for Golf Channel, and I can tell you what the travel is like to go over there. It sucks. It's fun when you get there, but it's hell getting there. And then Australia is no different than South Africa from what my friends tell me. I've never been down there, but it's a long trip too. British Isles wouldn't be too bad. Guys on the West Coast would struggle a little more than the guys on the East Coast of the United States, that is. But yeah, we used to play at the Grove, which was, funny enough, a Kyle Phillips design. Mm-hmm. For the WGC Amex back in the day. Last year it was there. I think it was 06 was the last year it was there when Amex had the sponsorship. And it was an okay golf course. Tiger ran roughshod over the field. Shocking. but at least they took it to someplace different. But the reason they don't is for that reason alone, I think, right there. If you could pinpoint on one thing, Andy, it's the field before would get killed and the field after would get killed. Mm-hmm. And these tournament directors just don't want that to happen. And I don't blame them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it would be the scheduling side of things is the most difficult aspect of it. So with since you've moved from playing to the booth, like how has your perspective of golf changed?
Oh, it looks a lot easier. It looks a lot. These guys are so good. And it's, you know, I don't remember it being this easy or looking this easy the way the guys make it look. And there are times I'm sure that I made it look easy myself. I think we all do as professionals at some point in our careers. I find myself admittedly forgetting how hard it is. And maybe at times being, I don't think I'm overly critical of guys at times. I think I balance it out fairly well. There's some times where I think about it, I go, you know what? I say something and I think about it and then, you know, on the commercial break and I'll sit there and go, you know what? That was a lot harder than I made it sound. And I need to respect how hard it is to hit some of the shots that these guys hit and they pull off. Mm-hmm. And, you lose perspective, I think, to a certain extent when you've been away from playing at the highest level amount of time. But it's something that's going to happen to all of us because you can't play at the highest level for forever. So it's an interesting balance that Golf Channel has to deal with players, because no player comes right off the golf course. They've got the knowledge and the understanding and so on and so forth, but they're so raw on TV, they don't understand the mechanics of television. So they're usually not very good on TV until they learn the mechanics and when and how to say things and so on and so forth. But they've got fantastic information. That's the double-edged sword. You know, that's the thing where you're like, oh, this guy's, he understands perfectly because he was just there. But as you grow into the role, you start understanding mechanics and when to say things and when not to say things and how to put things and how to do highlights properly. And the mechanics become easier, but then you tend to forget how freaking hard the game is at times. and you can tend to be a little harsher than you should be with some of the guys. So that striking that balance is important for me as an analyst, whether I'm doing live golf or I'm doing studio golf. And making sure doing live golf is huge for me because it helps me understand on a weekly basis what these guys go through on a regular basis. Because I'm out there and I see the shots and I see the lies and I'm right there on the ground. I hear the conversations between the caddies and the players. I see the looks on their faces when the cameras aren't there and you can't see them on television. You know, and that brings me back and helps me to understand what these guys are going through on a regular basis, because as players we've all been there.
Yeah, so what shot do you think is like the most underappreciated shot that pros like make look so easy?
Great question. Golly, I think it's all dependent upon kind of from a player's perspective. I was never a good fader of the golf ball. I was always my fade was a 2 yard fall to the left. I think that for me, whenever I stand up and watch a guy hit an effortless bomb fade like Rahm or Dustin, and it just doesn't come down and it's the sweetest little 10 yard fall to the right with the driver, I'm like, oh God, that looks so easy. Why can't I do that? From my perspective, I look at that and I'm in awe because I could never do that all that well. But for the average Joe sitting at home, 10 handicap, five to 15 handicap, and the guys that I play with that I played with in pro-ams, I'd have to say the most underrated shot, the medium trajectory. This is going to get real golfy. The medium trajectory mid yardage spinner with the wedge.
Kind of like JT hit last night.
Exactly. kind of like that. But I see that a guy hit a bad drive. He's got to play. Now he's got to make a U.S. Open style par. He pitches out from the rough a la Torrey Pines. And he's got 75, 85 yards. And the pin's tucked front over a bunker, and he throws this gorgeous medium trajectory, spinny little floater in there that just comes down like a butterfly with sore feet. One hop stop, comes back maybe 3 or 4 feet to inside 10 feet and make it for par. That is an underrated skill on the PGA Tour. Underrated.
Those are just underrated pars too, because those are the pars that just keep your round going and that always get lost.
I call them round savers. And they are absolute round savers. Those that 8 to 15 footer you got to make for par because you've hit it in a dog awful spot. So they're all round savers. But that shot in particular, I watch amateurs struggle with that time and time and time again. They just can't hit it. They can't hit it. It's a very underrated shot.
Yeah.
I've seen 10 handicaps hit the most beautiful lob shots, and I go, whoa, that's pretty cool. You know, from a 10 handicap, but none of them can hit that floater, that medium spinny floater from 75, 85 yards.
That shot, and then I feel like when I see a guy, another shot I love, I always look at like with younger kids when I play in these amateur events is like, I know I'm playing with a kid that like, say he's a high schooler that really knows how to play when he takes two extra clubs into the wind and hits like a little choke flighter. As opposed to just taking extra club and hitting it hard and spinning it up.
Yes. And guys, And, you know, it's funny. You come back to – now we come back to the young kids on tour and how their games evolve. Totally. That's how I can tell. Jason Day, what did he do when he came out on tour, Andy? Everything was nuke. Take one lesson, nuke it. Didn't matter what the wind was doing. Take one lesson, nuke it. JT, same thing. Take one lesson, nuke it. Now both those guys have developed soft arm shots, mm-hmm. you know? And that's – you have to have those shots if you want to win major championships, period. Tiger talks about it. You watch – all you need to do is just go back and look at any of the 14 majors Tiger won and just fast forward through all the days and just have them cut out all of the shots of everybody else and just watch Tiger's shots and watch how many half swings that – or three-quarter swings that guy makes. A ton. You got to have them. Three-quarter cut shots, three-quarter draw shots. You got to have them.
Yeah, especially in bad conditions like wind. I mean, if you don't have that shot, you're dead. All right, we've already, you know, we've covered like half of what I wanted to get through. So I want to get into some overrated, underrateds, So overrated, underrated, the idea of Masters prep.
Prep in what regard?
Like, you know, well, he's prepping for Augusta by playing here, or he's prepping for Augusta by doing the
dude, that's overrated. You can't prep for Augusta by playing a certain golf course. No way. That's BS. No chance. Nothing prepares you for what that golf course is going to throw at you. Geez, nothing prepares you for the way the golf course changes from Wednesday to Thursday in the span of 8 hours. I mean, they can turn the screws on that thing at any time. It's just, forget about it, kids. Never moving on.
Yeah, it's funny. I talked to Stuart Hagestad. He said the same thing about how much the golf course changes from Wednesday to Thursday.
All of us do. It did when I played it. I mean, it was just like all of us Tuesday and Wednesday. You go out for a Tuesday practice round. You're like, oh, okay, hitting the shots, seeing the ball the way the ball reacts. Okay, I got this. Wednesday, kind of the same deal. You play 9 holes because they close the golf course down. Early, you go play the par three, you wake up the next morning, you hit your first shot into one, and you're like, oh, shit, what happened? Honestly, that's exactly your reaction. What happened?
that's all right, so overrated Masters prep. So what about 18-hole playoffs? Timely one.
For our nation's championship, I'm going to say they're underrated, and I'm going to get totally outvoted on this one. But it was something there was something special about an 18-hole Monday playoff for the toughest test in golf. And I'm hoping the USGA gets back to that, the toughest test in golf, because I mean, listen, I was a player. I bitched about how difficult Oakmont was in 07 and complained. And you know what? That's just part of it. And I want to hear players do that again, because I don't hear enough complaining. And when I start hearing more complaining, that's when I know we've gotten back to the toughest test in golf. But I think that an 18-hole playoff on Monday is worthy of the toughest test in golf for our nation's championship. Quite honestly, some people would say, no, it's not. You're not going to get the, you know. And now they obviously the news. They changed it, and it's going to be a 2-hole aggregate. And I understand why they did that. And I'm sure it'll be great. It'll be fine. They'll finish it on Sunday, which there's positives to that. But I will miss the 18 hole, waking up the next morning and, you know, turning on the TV and sitting down, or guys in the office watching it on their, you know, in 08, watching it on their computers or wherever they could turn on a TV and watching it. There's something special about that too, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't like the 2-hole, like, how'd you get 2?
I honestly think they wanted to be different, Andy, because you got a 3-hole aggregate in the PGA. You got a 4-hole aggregate in the Open. I just think they wanted to be different. That's my humble opinion. If they come up, if they give me an answer that I can believe, and they're not just selling me something, I'll buy it. But in my humble opinion, I just think they needed something different. They just wanted to be different than the other two majors.
Well, they probably did some big study that nobody ever saw the results of, except for a few people.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. So I think every Every golf fan secretly wishes for Monday playoff 18 holer.
Yeah, yeah. I think all of us golf nerds who are true golf nerds like myself. I mean, I dig that. I mean, I loved it. I loved watching the one, Scott Simpson and Payne Stewart.
Yeah.
I remember that one.
Tiger Rocco.
Hale Irwin, Mike Donald. When I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. So Tiger Rocco, obviously, is going to be the last one. So I'll miss that. We're losing some nostalgia. You know, we'll have nostalgia now for that, but we're losing a little bit. I think we're losing a little bit not having an 18-hole Monday playoff, in my opinion.
It's just an odd thing that, like, there's so much about tradition and history, and, like, this is one of, like, the staples and, like, one differentiator of the championship. And they're we'll get rid of it.
Yeah, but the way the USGA is going, it's they're they're listening, finally, which I give them so much credit for. Because they're listening to the pros, they're listening to the people, they're listening, and they're modernizing to a certain extent. They are. And I appreciate them for that. I just don't want them to modernize themselves to where the championship itself is unrecognizable. Like, no offense to the great people at Erin Hills. I don't want to see another U.S. Open at Erin Hills. I really don't. It's not a U.S. Open golf course. Great PGA course, maybe even a Ryder Cup course, but that's a PGA Championship style golf course, not a U.S. Open style golf course. We need to stick to U.S. Open 1920s greats. We need to stick to Riv, Pebble, Shinnecock, Bethpage, Black, even though I don't think they're going to go back there now because I think that's more of a PGA type course.
Marion.
You know, Marion. Yeah, we need to stick to the old guard, in my opinion. And not trick them up.
So like
the way they were meant to be played.
So like there should be a U.S. Open Rota, just like the Open Rota.
Absolutely, there should be a U.S. Open Rota. Don't just take some dude's, you know, cash if that's the way it's happening, and go to some place just because you want to be different. Stick to Olympic Club. Stick to the greats, the ones that have stood the test of time.
I think the other thing that does is it adds value to the viewer, because like two of the most popular events on TV are the Players and the Masters, and because they're played at the same course year in, year out, big events, and they have like people remember the finishes at those places and the holes.
Exactly. So how cool is it that every 5 years, you know, you're going back to St. Andrews for the most part?
It doesn't stink.
It doesn't stink. You look forward to every 5 years we're going to be at St. Andrews. Or for me, this year, Carnoustie. I love Carnoustie. Some people might have an affinity with Muirfield. You know you're going back to Muirfield. Well, I don't know anymore, but maybe, hopefully, we're going back to Muirfield. Or maybe some guys you're a Lytham and St. Ann's guy. So, you know you can count on certain ones in that Open Rota, and I'd love for the USGA to do that with the great old golf courses in the United States. And quite honestly, I would love, my humble opinion, I would love East Coast, West Coast, bounce back and forth each year.
I don't know if there's enough courses for that, though, on the West Coast.
Well, but remember, if it's a Rota, you're fine.
Yeah.
So if you do Torrey, Riv, LA Country Club, or I don't know if you could do both of those. You probably have to do one or the other. Pebble, Olympic. So you've got, what is that, four or five courses just on the West Coast?
Yeah.
Now you do four or five on the East Coast. So now you have 8 to 10. Maybe you can add a couple more. There's more on the East Coast.
Yeah, way
you
know, more.
You can get up to 12 golf courses, but if you bounce back and forth, or every two years instead of every other year, or every 3 years, every third year you come back to a West Coast course, I think that'd be cool.
You know, I have to say, you're just dissing the Midwest, just because I'm a Midwester. If I didn't say something, I was going to hear some heat for that.
You're right. I don't mean to diss the Midwest,
but I don't know if we really have a great golf course for that in the Midwest.
I'm trying to think of Chicago.
Inverness with the redesign could be one.
Yeah, is that too short though still?
I think it's 7,400, 7,500 yards.
Oh, that'd work for sure. Yeah, no doubt. I didn't realize they added that much length to it.
I'm not positive though. It might only be 70. I haven't been out there yet, so. But yeah,
obviously there's lots of great ones in Chicago, but you know, Olympia Fields. I was there for the ladies KPMG PGA Championship last year, and the guys would turn that into a pitch and putt now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
from the back tees, they ran out of real estate, and that's obviously leads to another discussion about the ball, and technology. But
that's a future pod. I had it on my list of topics, and we're not getting into that.
We're not going to get there today. Yeah, no, but that's that. Yeah, but I agree. I think there needs to be a rotation. I think that the USGA set in a rotation. I think that would be fantastic, actually.
Yeah, and it would be good weather in all those places for it. Like,
for the most part, you can still get the occasional stoppage of play on the East Coast. But yeah, the West Coast, smooth sailing. You might have to worry about a fog delay here and there, but nothing major.
The West Coast would be so great with it finishing at like 9 o'clock.
Exactly. That's what my argument all the time for West Coast events is, hey, guys, TV people on prime time on the East Coast, you know? For a West Coast event, and I think TV digs West Coast events, but the one thing you don't have to worry about, like I said, other than fog, and you can get the fog at Olympic or at Pebble or Torrey in June
gloom.
There's no doubt. June gloom. There's no doubt. But other than the fog, you're not getting lightning and you're not getting rain. So, you know, and the fog is somewhat rare to a certain extent. So weather delays would be few and far between, in my opinion.
Yeah. So, last overrated, underrated, and this was going to be a topic, but we're just going to throw it in here. The resurgent Phil Mickelson.
Oh God. I always think Phil's underrated. he's so good. I mean, the guy astounds me. He's amazing. Definitely underrated. I think that at 47, almost 48 years old, to be able to still swing it between 116 and 120 miles an hour is incredible, in my opinion. It's a testament to his desire to continue to work and find things to get better at, which is hard to do at 47, 48. Because I know there are plenty of guys in their early to mid 40s that are having a hard time doing that. And maybe even late 30s having a hard time trying to figure out, you know, motivation to go out there and work on things. But, you know, his hernia surgeries really set him back speed wise. And I didn't know if he was able to get all that speed back from those hernia surgeries. And lo and behold, he's been able to get a lot of it back. And, that's a big thing for him.
Hitting it longer than he ever hit it before in his career.
I know. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's, you know, listen, you can't discount technology for both him and Tiger. Technology's helping both those boys. There's no doubt. The optimization of the ball and the club and the shaft, club head and the shaft, without a doubt. TrackMan helping those boys big time. But they still got to get in the gym and get it done and put in hours and hours of work on their bodies at 40, you know, 42 and 47 years old. In Phil's case. And so, I'm all in on a Phil resurgence. It's just a matter of, can he put it all together? You know, it's one thing each week so far. He's so close, but it's one thing each week. It's either his, and luckily his short game and his putting's been there pretty much every week, which in your 40s, that's usually the first thing that goes. You get a little, you know, yippity doo-dah around the greens with the putter and the wedges at times. Phil not even showing zero signs of that. But he's just either struggled a little bit off the tee or he struggled with the irons. So if he can find a week where he puts those two things together, he can win.
Yeah.
There's no doubt he can win.
I kind of am feeling this week. It's at altitude. He's always played really well at altitude
because he doesn't have to hit a lot of drivers in.
Yeah. And the ball goes straighter.
That's a good thing.
In altitude.
Well, that might not be a good thing for him, actually. he likes to see it curve. So one thing about altitude that I think that is actually, if we're doing underrated or overrated, is underrated. The one thing about altitude, it's hard to curve the ball.
Yeah.
at altitude because there's less guys who really like to curve it, like Bubba and those guys, and like to work the ball. Those guys might struggle a little bit in Mexico. We'll see. We'll have to wait and see. But that's kind of one of my, you know, hypotheses, if you will, or theories that I have with guys. So if Phil can adjust to that, yeah, there's no doubt he can win Mexico.
I think he won that, like, what, international that used to get played at
He did. But that was that. How long ago that was? Gosh.
But he was in contention last year too. There. So
yeah, maybe it's working for him. He understands exactly what he needs to do. So maybe altitude is straightening his ball out for him.
I mean, and it's one of the things, like, you know, he's like, he thinks about all those different factors of a shot. Oh, I mean, it's perfect for him.
I wish there was a thought bubble on television above Phil's head, filled with all the stuff that's going through it as he's trying to calculate yardages. That would be classic. That'd be fantastic. Because the permutations and the algorithms that have to be going through his head to get all this stuff done. And I honestly think it's going to be less with his brother, with Tim on the bag, than it was with Bones. I almost think Bones gave him too much information, even though Phil wanted it. I don't think he needed it all. I don't think Tim gives him all of that, quite honestly. Maybe Phil doesn't want it, but it sure doesn't seem like it. I don't hear the same conversations with Tim and Phil as I did with Bones and Phil.
Bones was an enabler.
Bones was an enabler. I love it.
So, all right, last question, and then we'll get you out of here. All you need to give four names. Who are our major champions this year?
Oh, well, let's see. I'm going to go it's hard for me to go against statistics at the Masters. So I'm going to go based on what Justin Rae sent me, and I'm not going to name him off, but I'm going to go with Justin Rose at the Masters. God, I hope he putts well, because that's pretty much all he needs to do there. And let's see. I'm going to go U.S. Open, Shinnecock. I'm going to go with Spieth at the U.S. Open.
All right.
I think he gets his second U.S. Open. I think that's going to be a great golf course for him. Very creative and going to move the ball around a lot, and short game is going to be required and grinding is going to be required. I think the USGA is going to get back to a more traditional U.S. Open setup. But still, I think they're going to allow you some angles. They're not going to allow you all the angles you usually get at Shinnecock, but they're going to allow you a few more. Carnoustie. Ooh, boy, you need a ball striker.
Yeah, you got to bring your big boy pants there.
It's got to be a big boy at Carnoustie, I think. Let's see.
Sergio.
That's the obvious choice, obviously, for what happened in 07. But, oh, gosh, this is hard. I'm going to go with John Rahm.
That's a good pick.
I'm going to go with John Rahm. He's still raw, and he's got a little ways to go. But on a golf course like that, where ball striking is paramount, I mean, you got to nut it around that place. I like John Rahm, especially when the weather can turn on a dime.
Yeah.
Like it did in 07 when I was there. Let's see.
Bell Reeve.
Fowler gets off the schneid.
Yeah, that's it.
At Bell Reeve.
That'd be a good place for him. That'll be a soft and slow golf course.
Yeah, and my other choice after him was going to be Rory, because it is going to be soft and slow, and Rory's won all his majors on soft, slow golf courses.
Yeah.
I like Ricky to get off the schneid there, and get his first major.
He's got to get one eventually. It's
got to happen. I mean, it'd be a shame if it never did. I think he's got the talent to do it, and he's got the game to do it. He's just got to do it.
Yeah.
And I think Bell Reeve is just as good as any place for him, but I think it gives him an opportunity. Fairways are a little wider. As you said, it's going to play a little softer. And so I think the firm, fast, bouncy, rolly stuff isn't going to be there, and it's going to protect some of maybe the occasional wild shot that he's capable of hitting, even though he's been very, very good with staying away from big numbers of late, which has always been kind of his Achilles heel in the past.
Thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. And what do you got up next for Golf Channel so our listeners can tune in and catch you on TV?
I'll be with the Champions Tour guys, PGA Tour Champions guys, at Tucson this week. I leave on Thursday morning, for which will be tomorrow morning if everybody's listening to it. Thursday morning with down there for our production meeting, and then which is nice, just about an hour and a half drive or so for me from Phoenix. And then I'll go the following week to Toshiba over in Newport Beach for the PGA Tour Champions as well. So next 2 weeks, PGA Tour Champions. I like that tour. It's a lot of fun. Love working with Lanny and John and John Cook and Billy Ray. They're just a great group of guys to work with and be around.
Man, Tucson and Newport Beach aren't too bad spots to hang out at.
I'll get great Mexican food 1 week and great seafood the next week.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on again, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, big guy. Talk to you later, Andy.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.